Hello and welcome to the Ancient Warfare Magazine podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. In this episode, we'll be looking at Volume 8, Issue 5, Rebellion Against the Empire, the Jewish-Roman Wars. Joining me to discuss the topic is Joshua Bowers, Lindsay Powell, Mark McCaffrey and Joseph Hall. Before we look at the three wars, I wonder if someone could give us some background to the region and Rome's control over it.
Perhaps goes back to the Maccabean Rebellion in about 167, I think, 167. The Jews revolt against the Seleucid rulers and found an independent Jewish state, the Hasmonean state, but inhabiting a state of their own. Now the Jews have something tangible to defend and to fight for, and so we see quite a large outgrowth from that of Jewish nationalism. I'd say the next thing to do with Rome anyway was in 63 BC when Pompey the Great brought the region into the Roman sphere of influence. But Rome governed the region via the Hasmonean rulers who they'd kept in place. The Roman Civil Wars, I think, which ended in Octavian's victory, this also impacted the local politics of Judea. But the outcome was that Rome installed Herod as the sole ruler. After Herod's death in 4 BC, his son Archelaus took over Judea, but he was even more unpopular than Herod, which is a feat in itself, I think. Because of this, Archelaus and his mismanagement, let's say, the Jews appealed to Rome in AD 6. They deposed Archelaus and decided to bolt Judea onto the Roman province of Syria, but allowed Jews a kind of semi-autonomy still. I think you could probably make the case that this is the point where Rome and the Jews first clashed, because the job of organising taxation for this new area that was bolted onto Syria, fell to the Syrian governor Quirinius, who changed the taxes from being paid in kind to being paid with cash, monies. And this is a lot less flexible system, I think. Or that was perceived to be a lot less flexible system anyway. And also, Roman coinage depicted pagan gods and the divine emperor. And so, from a Jewish perspective, using these coins, you're breaking two commandments in one go, aren't you? Thou shalt have no other gods, thou shalt not make idols. I suppose you could also say it goes back to Sabinus. That's AD 4, I think, when Herod had died. A Roman official was sent over to Judea, if I'm remembering this rightly, and is charged with the job of reviewing Herod's estate. He was told to leave the treasures and the citadel of Herod's estate in place and intact, and leave them to his son Archelaus. Herod's will was just about to be ratified by the Senate, but he didn't. He decided to ignore that. It caused a revolt amongst all the Jews in Jerusalem by burning parts of the temple down, by plundering the treasury, basically being as insensitive as you'd expect a Roman to be in that situation. And the revolt was only squashed, it was a minor revolt, but it was only quashed when the governor of Syria came rampaging down with forces of his own to kind of put a halt on it all. And so before the first revolt even, we have quite a lot of enmity bubbling under the surface. This small, from the Roman perspective, small incidents. From the Jewish perspective, it's never a case of, oh, there's been a minor blip in our relations with Rome. There's always something.
And Romanization, which is a tool they would have used to bring people into the fold and hopefully keep the peace, had failed with them. Was there something intrinsically hostile, that was never going to work between Jews and Rome?
Well, in this issue's historical introduction, I think it's Mladen Popovich, he sets out the debate between scholars who believe, on the one hand, that the clash of cultures was inevitable, that there was something intrinsically hostile, and those scholars who see no essential incompatibility between Roman rule and Judaism. I'm not sure I'm convinced by that. I find it quite hard to see how Judaism, which let's not forget, isn't just a religion at this time, it's also tied up with nationalism, with the idea of political autonomy. And, well, I find it hard to see how it could view any form of sovereignty which is forced to be placed above itself. with anything other than hostility. I mean, is that not the, to the modern eye, is that not the definition of being dominated, of oppression?
Yeah, especially considering the fact that the monotheistic religion of the Jews was completely incompatible with the Roman polytheistic religion. I mean, the Roman emperors themselves, after death, usually are deified. So most of the time, the Roman emperors would have been the sons of gods also, which is completely incompatible with the Jewish belief system, of course. So that's a definite source for friction.
So we have the first revolt. I mean, we get three revolts in 70 years. Do we need to see these? Can we view these as one occurrence with breaks, or are they three individual wars or revolts with different causes and different reasons, or are they kind of a continuation with where it dies down between?
It depends on whether you want to believe our major source of Josephus or not, really, here, because on the one hand, you can take the perspective that, you know, there are certain little key moments that kick off these revolts, as he might tell us, or you can look at the empire as a whole and take into consideration what was happening politically in Rome. Was that actually affecting what's happening out in the outer provinces? Is this a time when Rome, by showing itself a little bit weak as a structure, is seen weak by those around, and therefore they grab opportunities? So therefore, should we link revolts in the east to revolts in places like Britannia or along the Germanic borders? Depends on which of those avenues you wish to take.
I just had it in my mind that it's a localized problem with the Romans winding up the Jewish fraternity. But was there anything back politically in Rome that actually might have been stirring the pot?
I mean, it depends on your interpretation of the career of Nero. On the one hand, you get Caligula, who is, depending on which of our sources you believe, whether he shows himself to be a potentially weak emperor. But of course, then you... there are successes that he has in his career. Then you have Nero, who, again, we think of Nero for all the wrong reasons, of course. The madness of Nero and whatnot. But for most of his time, there doesn't seem to be huge problems in the empire as a whole. But then you do have issues like, for example, the rebellion of Boudicca in Britannia. Is that to link with Nero as such? Is he being... I mean, one of his policies is to send out people to be in charge of provinces who he can trust as not threatening his own position and therefore may not be the best people for positions of authority in the provinces.
There is some instability around AD 70, of course, with the year of the four emperors also. Mm. And with a revolt in Germania Inferior also. Yeah. So it could very well be that the Jews thought, oh, you know, now's our time. The Roman Empire is weak or distracted. Let's strike while the iron is hot or something. That might have been a factor in 70 at least.
I'm doing research right now about the age of the Emperor Augustus and how rebellions and... just generally, civil disorder was part of the makeup of normal society. And I've come to the conclusion that really rebellions and skirmishes and uprisings were part of the great fabric of the Roman Empire. The army was constantly engaged at some point or other, quelling some kind of action somewhere with somebody. And the extraordinary thing is that a great many of them are recorded at all, because what we have, for example, from Dio Cassius, his references to book 51, where he talks about, I think in the year 29 or 30, that there were lots of things going on that year, but there's far too many to mention, and anyway, they weren't very important, so I haven't described them here. And it makes you wonder how much of that kind of Roman history hasn't come down to us. How many more of these sort of Jewish revolts there were in different parts of the empire? And I certainly know they weren't unique. I certainly know in northern Spain, the Asturians and the Cantabrians, for something like 10 years, resisted Roman attempts at subjugation, as indeed the people in the Balkans, the Diates and the Broiki being the ones. And Britain, of course, has its own cases of insurrection and insurgency. So I think the what it comes down to is that that the Roman army was constantly on security detail and duty. What we tend to hear is only the big name stories, Bar Kokhba, people like that, Ben Eleazar and all these other people.
Shall we look at the first revolt? I mean, was it a general revolt? Are we just talking a small rabble-rousing faction that pulled people together, or is it a general revolt and everyone joined in? There was nobody one person driving it, was there?
Well, it depends if you believe Josephus, really. I mean, Josephus obviously has his own reasons for portraying the outbreak of the first war the way he did. But if you did believe Josephus, then yes, he seems to think that the entire nation was incited to this war by a few zealots, a few hotheads, really. And we don't really know to what extent. We don't have a 360 degree view of what happened in the area, so we can only really rely on Josephus saying these hotheads were unhappy with Rome. They found fertile ground for the things they were saying, and they managed to kind of raise a rebellion in which everyone was happy to go along with. Now, whether we should read anything into the fact that he says the wider community was happy to go along with it, and because it was quite a large revolt, he says it's one of the largest battle, the largest wars that Romans ever fought until that time. Whether he was trying to place himself alongside Thucydides there by saying, this is the largest war and look at me, I'm writing about it, we don't know.
Did the Romans anticipate it? Was the region lightly garrisoned? Or,
you haven't got a huge number of troops over there. I mean, what troops there are, it seems that they're fairly spread out, not based as a legionary base as such, like most of the rest of the empire, but rather dispersed in cohorts through the area in a couple of key positions. But of course, the cohorts responsible for the areas that did flare up originally aren't enough to deal with the trouble. And you seem to have some relatively insensitive behaviour from some of the troops as well.
I think there was a lot of friction among the Romans as well as among the Jews because of the cultural differences, and that sort of made it a volatile situation at times. So those revolts were probably bubbling along the surface all the time.
If you want to talk about Roman insensitivity, then you can't not mention Jesius Florus, who I think it was in 66 Nero needed cash, and Jesus Florus was sent in on his behalf to confiscate cash from the temple. I mean, I think today, amongst the kind of non-Jewish layperson just reading about this, it's easy to forget what the temple means. I mean, the temple is everything. It is the center of worship, and the Jewish diaspora, where you have however many tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Jews living outside of Judea, at this point, they're all drawn to their homeland in Judea, because that's where the temple is. That's their homeland. They have the temple tax, which they pay, which goes to the upkeep and for the glorification of the temple. And so to have a kind of a Roman representative just almost offhandedly told to go to the temple, we need some money, the temple has money, go and take it. I don't think that went down too well. There's almost a sense of, well, we're in charge now. We're the Romans. We've beaten you. Do as everyone else has done and put up with it.
Such an offence also would be interpreted as, you know, affecting not just the Jewish population locally, but also, as you said, therefore, across the Eastern Mediterranean. There's reference to one group in Egypt establishing another Jewish temple in Egypt, but that not actually being given any of the same respect as the original temple in Jerusalem. So again, foreign communities looking back to the motherland and taking a lead from there.
We're talking about the diaspora. The Jewish diaspora in Mesopotamia was the closest in size and influence to the the homeland in Judea. And yet, I mean, they even enjoyed a lot more control and autonomy, almost, under the Parthians. And yet, however large that became and however much influence they garner for themselves, because they weren't under the strict rules of Rome, they always looked back west to the homeland. And so it was never as though they'd created a home away from home which could eventually get bigger than the temple in Judea. However big they got, it was always, no, we are, there was rivalry, but it was always, we are subordinate to the homeland in Judea, we are subordinate to the temple, that is our homeland. And any offence caused then, as in Jesus Florus in the temple, and anything that happens in Judea is going to be felt by all of us in the diaspora.
Could that be also interpreted with Trajan moving eastwards with some of his conquests, that one of the rebellions actually happens where he has to move troops from his planned Parthian campaign back to deal with rebels in Judea and the surrounding areas? Could this be a reaction by, you know, rather than just saying this is a good opportunity to rebel as the troops are being refocused to the east, could it also be a consideration of, well, if Trajan's looking to expand eastwards, it means we're going to be further inside the empire as such, and therefore consumed by it. There's no escape from it now if Trajan takes on the Parthians and takes more of their empire.
I suppose from their point of view, if you take that attack, they are no longer on the edge of empire, are they? There's no longer that opportunity to throw off the Roman yoke. Because if you're in the middle of the Roman Empire, well, if you're surrounded on every side by, like, geographically, by Roman provinces, there's not much you can do, is there? You'll always be surrounded.
And once we have the revolt, you know, on three occasions, how does the Roman army deal with it?
Well, as far as Rome's concerned, I think, especially Rome with counterinsurgency, to begin with, at least, there's always the same kind of reaction. It's quite a consistent policy from Rome, as far as I remember, that they send whoever's nearest, and they just try and fight the fire immediately before it can get out of hand, with whatever they've got, and with it, if that means sending a small vexillation you've got stationed nearby to try and stamp out a numerically superior force, then so be it. They never wanted to be seen to be not doing the utmost they could at the utmost with the utmost urgency.
Do the sources, how the Romans policed it, or is it just a broad brush of what they did? I mean, do we have a lot of sources other than Josephus? So do we have sources from all sides, or is it purely all from the Roman perspective?
Well, a lot of it is just from Josephus. I mean, there are quite a few incidents in the first revolt where, for example, the siege of Jotapata, where Josephus is captured. We don't know about that from anywhere else. And so we really are taking Josephus on his word for a lot of these things, and he doesn't always go into much detail about the everyday grind of war, the kind of day by day as it happened, what was sent, or who was sent where, and how did they counter particular insurgencies in particular areas. We just don't have that kind of information.
With a lot of Roman sources, I mean, like with problems about Roman Britannia, there is a focus on key figures, and for example, with Vespasian or Titus, it's biographers looking at their lives and how these campaigns impact on their careers. And we've got that being painted in broad swathes rather than any detail as such. And where it, you know, the information that we're given, whether it can be relied upon, whether it's, you know, propaganda, whether it's propaganda on Josephus's part as well. It's a dangerous ground to tread.
So the Roman army goes in, they take an aggressive stance. I think in all three occasions, essentially, the Jewish people fall back on their strongholds, and this allows them to take them out one at a time. Were any of the sieges particularly notable, or did the Romans just, you know, one by one knock them off?
The siege of Jotapata is where Josephus is captured, and we get an interesting account of that from him, only from him as well. We'd have nothing if it wasn't for survival of Josephus' records, or if he had died that day, as a lot of his co-religions did, we wouldn't have even known that happened. But as far as knocking them off one by one, I think it was more a case of like you say, they retreated to their strongholds, and that was it. And they were enabled to, well, they were allowed to be picked off one by one. There was never, as far as my memory says, there was never a large Jewish force in the field. Now, you could say there were quite a few reasons for that. I think the main reason is because people of the era as well, know what the Romans can do in the field. I mean, I don't think I'd like to. I don't think I'd like to take on the Roman legions of that time if I was an insurgent, and I was fighting with my fellow insurgents. You'd do what you think is going to get you the best outcome, which is what they did, but it didn't give them the best outcome, unfortunately, for them.
But they did. Don't they believe during the? I think it's Josephus again estimates the figures to be not dissimilar, evenly matched. Why was there not? Was there not somebody organizing, moving people around? Why could they not pull themselves together?
Well, I was going to say, I'm actually when I finish the current book, I'm going to be writing on about Bar Kokhba, stroke Bar Kozhiba. And the one thing that strikes me about that whole thing is that, much as I've said about all these other people, I think it's the one thing that's quite obvious is Jewish populations seemed uniquely to be able to get their act together and could, in a sense, run a nation state within the Roman Empire. And I suppose the great first Jewish rebellion was the first stab at that, and it through the minting of coins and so on, they got their idea of nationhood. And Bar Kozhiba, Bar Kokhba, later on in 132 turned 55, singly succeeded in doing that for 4 years. And of course, Hadrian had to throw several legions and Severus and several other auxiliary cohorts to finally break that. So I think that it's interesting that the Jewish population, maybe because of their cultural identity, were able to achieve something that some of the other nation states were not able to. What you'll find is that the Asturians, for example, for a campaign season, they're able to cause trouble for the Romans. Romans at the end of the season, they crush them and it's done. And they think they've got away with it, and the next season they'll rise up again. The difference with the Jewish state is that they're able basically to put in their administration as well, and they get all the instruments of government and law and all the rest of it working, which I don't think any other people successfully did.
Yeah, they were still wracked by factionalism, which meant they couldn't really put an army in the field or organise themselves militarily.
Well, I think that's part of the whole region. It is factionalised, and remember, we're pitting them against the Roman army. And so on one side you're saying, okay, you could say nominally on one side you have 65,000 people, the other side you have the same amount, but it's the institution which backs it up. You have on one side a kind of factionalized, semi-autonomous or wanting to be semi-autonomous nation, and on the other you have an institution in the Roman army which has the entire Roman Empire behind it and which is geared towards exactly this kind of action. Geared towards pitched battles or sieges or things like this. You have to remember as well, these are professional soldiers, and a lot of the fighters within the Jewish ranks, I mean, they're just not professional soldiers. You can say the numbers, they have parity in numbers, but they don't have parity in anything like experience is probably the best way, and skill at arms, things like that. And so even if Josephus had said the Jews had double the numbers of the Romans, I still don't think they would have had much luck having at them in a pitched battle. I think they would have still been forced to kind of go to their mountain or fortresses and try and ride it out that way, and maybe just have a guerrilla war for however long that took.
Well, they seem to have done a lot of fighting amongst themselves, which kind of helped.
Help the Romans, yeah.
well, exactly. So, I mean, the Romans sat there while their factions within Jerusalem fought amongst themselves, which Vespasian could sit back and let the siege roll.
Yes, sir. What's that saying? Never interrupt your enemy when he's making a mistake.
And going up against the Roman Empire must have been disheartening also. I mean, if you look at Masada, according to the traditions, in the end they committed suicide because they didn't see a way out. If you're up against the Roman Empire, you're basically up against a force that is in control of, as far as everybody knows, the vast majority of the known world, with an endless supply of soldiers also. So the idea is also, why do they even think they can revolt, especially multiple times? Why do they even try? I think it all goes back to the cultural differences, where they feel sort of obliged to rebel against Roman rule. Or would I be mistaken in that?
No, I think there is a point there. I think also, as I said earlier, with Josephus, he seems to think that there was no point in the revolt, that it was ultimately futile, and that the mass of people were drawn to the war. They were told that they could have certain things that they wanted, and they were incited almost into this thing which was ultimately catastrophic for them.
Well, when Josephus says that it's futile, isn't he just also sort of whitewashing his own surrender in that case? I surrendered, but I didn't have a choice, because that's more or less what he says, if I recall correctly.
It is, but when we only have his view for a lot of it, I mean, we're kind of between a rock and a hard place, aren't we? We believe him on certain points, but we just have to flag up when we know that he has ulterior motives for what he's saying, which unfortunately is most of the time.
So, Lindsay, tell us about Masada.
Oh, great. Masada, anybody who's seen it in pictures isn't really properly prepared for when they actually finally go there. It is absolutely enormous. Of course, you've got the central rock, which formed effectively the Acropolis, where Herod built his, summer palace, which has extraordinary plumbing and swimming pools and granaries and all the other sort of fine things that he needed. And very close by, you've got the Dead Sea. And then, of course, you've got this amazing preservation of Roman circumvallation and forts and so forth. And when eventually you've got up to the top by cable car, or if you've actually had the means to walk up there by foot, the rock itself towers above the Roman fortifications, and it really does sort of boggle your mind how the Romans actually were able to raise siege works in the time they did, and furthermore to push a siege tower up the top there. And it is an extraordinary place to visit, and understandably the Jews have made it something quite sacred in their modern state. But as an ancient monument, it really is, I think, second to none.
Isn't much stuff to be dug up that proves or disproves the sources at Masada?
Well, I think that we're in a sense, having read Josephus, you go with an expectation that you're going to see evidence of that siege, that you're going to see a hole in the wall, and of course you see the great ramp, and somehow you're going to see some evidence which ties it very closely to that event in AD 73, but actually when you get there, other than the ramp, and if you look at the ramp closely, most of that ramp, in fact, is a natural phenomenon. In fact, that the Romans were lucky they had this outcrop that they could simply build the additional ramp on. So they could probably build that much quicker than many people think. I don't recall there being much evidence of that particular event, and certainly I don't think they found anything that would be in the manner of people displaying evidence of suicide, that they were supposedly told they did. What is evident from the place is very much the presence of Herod the Great. I mean, that's his place. Right at the front end, if you like, at the front of the ship, if you will, if you draw that analogy, you've got this fabulous multi-level palace, and at the other end you've got these huge big granaries and so forth. I mean, the place is obviously designed to withstand a siege. And if indeed it was a place that there was a big slaughter, I would imagine that the Romans were quite keen to get rid of the evidence and turn the place to whatever use they wanted, because it probably was loaded with stores. I mean, it was for them a place that they could actually raid and use for their own ends.
It wasn't so much to get rid of the evidence, it's just you don't want bodies lying about on the ground in the sweltering Mediterranean sun for long. So that's what happens with most evidence for ancient battles or whatever. It's usually fairly slim because they remove all the dead 9 times out of 10. that had happened in Masada also. So there's no way, I think, you can prove whether they committed mass suicide using archaeology in this particular case. There's no evidence for it at all.
Yeah. So it comes back to the only evidence we've got that was a cogent, consistent story, of course, is Josephus' own account. And that's only one version, really. I don't recall there's anything in Erosius or Eusebius. But the other thing that struck me was the isolation of the place. When I went there, I stayed at a kibbutz, which is just down the road there, which is a little oasis of green and trees growing fruit crops and things like this. But the Dead Sea is very definitely a place, as its name suggests, you can't grow anything in it. I mean, it's not possible water. It raises the question that if you've got, I don't know how many legions were actually stationed at that place for the siege, was it maybe two, possibly three, maybe? If everybody's drinking a litre or two of water every day, that water's coming from somewhere. They must have an immense logistical supply chain just providing the basic commodity of water.
Could it have been used by the Romans or even the Jews at the time as well as a convenient political event?
Well, I think it was. I mean, the Arch of Titus gives you the story they're carved in stone. I mean, you had this magnificent triumph that went on. The menorah is displayed. I mean, the Temple of Jerusalem has been destroyed. And as far as they're concerned, I mean, Hiroshima has been obliterated. It's not going to be anything glorious again. And that's why Hadrian, 50 or so, 60 years later, has designs on making it into a Hellenistic city, because it's too good a place to actually abandon like that. And that's part of the reason why you get the Bacchopa War. But I think that the Romans turn it to wonderful propaganda. I mean, this is part of the Flavian household myth. I mean, Dad goes in, you know, Vespasian, and then Titus finishes the job, and out of that comes the Colosseum, and that enables them to scrub out the evil deeds of Nero and build this wonderful thing called the Colosseum, Amphitheatrum Flavium, which is given over to the people as their gift, if you like. So it's gifts all around everybody, really, on the backs of the Jewish people and their resistance.
We get one revolt after the other until the third time, when it would seemingly be put down once and for all. How did the Romans feel that they left it at the end of the first and second wars, which obviously failed, for them to really have to put it down for the third?
At the end of the second revolt, which is a generation or so before the Bar Kochba revolt, if the sources are to be believed, there is almost nothing left. I think I remember saying one of the sources, and I think in the article I wrote as well on the rebellion in the diaspora, some sources which say settlers had to be brought in to different regions like Cyrene, because the populations had been so decimated. And so it is surprising that there was enough fight left in the Jewish community to kick off the third revolt. Although that said, there's no real evidence that the second revolt took much of a hold in Judea at all. And so it could be that they're playing almost a kind of tag team. The first revolt happens in Judea. The second revolt, that's passed over to the communities in the diaspora. The third revolt sees the communities in the diaspora exhausted, so it goes back to the community in Judea.
So how did they finally put them down?
Well, it could be that they were just exhausted. There was perhaps by this point so much experience, not only within the Jewish institutions of what happens to your institution when you revolt against Rome, but also familial memory. Maybe I'm just going out on a limb here, but if the last few generations of my family had been decimated fighting the same enemy, I think I'd probably think twice about doing it again.
In Arnold Bloomberg's article in the issue, he notes that especially the punishment that Hadrian inflicted on the Jews by changing the province of Judea to Syria Palestina, and Jerusalem was renamed to Aelia Capitolina, and he also forbid a lot of stuff for the Jews. He told them they were forbidden from residing there and in the surrounding districts on pain of death. And there was a 1 day a year exception to this new ordinance. So I think the solution that the Romans came up with was basically try to take away as much of the Jewish identity as possible and also make it as difficult as possible for them to live there. because also the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, it's known as the Wailing Wall since the days of Hadrian. So apparently that was a big traumatic event where the Romans really tried to squash the Jewish will, at least, to resist once and for all. And it seems to have done the job for a while, at least.
Yeah, if you're almost cutting the heart out of Judaism, after a fashion, if Jerusalem and Judea is the center of everything, it is where they perceive their nation to be, the homeland of their culture, and the diaspora look toward Jerusalem for guidance. If you do such a thing as that, to take away, or to kind of to fragment or disperse that heart, maybe that did have more of an impact than we can appreciate today.
Yeah, especially because it was so integral to the Jewish identity, specifically because the like we talked about before, they had a very distinct notion of a particular homeland appointed to by God, of course, that was theirs, and there was an integral part of their cultural identity that perhaps other peoples in the ancient world didn't have as such. They were perhaps more flexible as far as geography was concerned. So if you take all of that away, you know, if you also move the people away and you change all the names and etc., yeah, like you say, it's basically gutting their own identity.
It's interesting that happened, though, after the Third Revolt, because you'd think that there would be an element of that in place already after the destruction of the temple in the First Revolt, because if the temple is the be-all and end-all, almost, then the destruction of that, I mean, there's not been a temple since, has there?
Mm-hmm.
You think the destruction of that that is the physical and spiritual heart of Judaism, or at least it was. That went at the end of the First Revolt, and yet there was still a second and a third revolt.
The outcome of the First Revolt, with Vespasian and Titus actually making a lot of their family wealth out of that war, maybe it's the taking of the physical wealth out of the area and whatnot. The Romans are focusing upon that rather than necessarily the ideological aspects of actually crushing that area. And maybe it's the Romans' idea that, well, they're taking the means of war out of there, and that's what leaves it so primed for future revolts, that the Roman idea is not that somebody's going to come back simply because of their religious ideas. Mm. And that hasn't been their experience in other areas. You take out the means of war and people give up.
Yeah, Hadrian may have been more sensitive to that than the more warlike or more belligerent emperors.
Mm.
Perhaps, especially because Hadrian was also more familiar, I think, with the eastern half of the empire than Titus maybe was with Vespasian. I don't know. So that may have been a factor, yeah.
Well, I wrote in one of the pieces when I was interviewing Karl Galinsky for the 2000th anniversary of Augustus's death, how we talk about the Pax Romana, which really is the Pax Augusta in historical sources. And you'll get people like Velius Paterculus and other people talk that up as being, no, bandits have been cast as under, and it's all peace and prosperity, and we're all happy and go about our business. And then you read the other accounts, you begin to realize that that's not quite the case. But the essence of the word pax that we translate as peace really also has another meaning, which is pact. And in order to have pax, you have to have war first. Pax happens when the warring parties agree to stop. And part of the game that the emperors play is this game that they need to have war at a certain level, one, because it enables them to control the army, but it also enables them to get glory, but finally also to be able to say mission accomplished, pax.
Which clearly in the case of the Jewish revolt, they never reached any pact at all. They literally had to crush them.
Well, that would be their definition of pax to some extent. I mean, the fact that they were able to take people like Josephus and rob the temple and so forth and have a triumph and have the famous Arch of Titus in Rome and display all the wealth and build the Colosseum, which was, if the reconstructed inscription is anything to go by, tells us that was ex manubis, that was from the spoils of war from the Jewish war. That was their version of pax. Whether the insurgents signed up for it didn't really matter. They had brought this phenomenon of peace to what was formerly warring nations.
They turn it into a wasteland and they call it peace.
That's what they would probably say. Of course, they use the word pacification. I mean, it's quite an intriguing word.
Were there any long-term effects to the Roman Empire? Was this a portent of things to come with problems on the inside of the borders rather than the Roman army having problems on its borders?
I don't think so. I mean, the Roman Empire at this stage in 1st, 2nd century AD, early 1st half of the 2nd century AD, it's gone from strength to strength, basically. I mean, the Roman Empire just it grew and grew and grew more powerful, and it managed to quash every opposition, even if it took a few tries, like with the Carthaginians also. So I don't think that was a particular problem. I think what you see in the later Roman Empire is something completely different, because you have these barbarians that push against the borders and are then invited partially to come inside and also barbarize the Roman Empire from the inside out. And it's also it's quite different, especially from what you see in the eastern half of the Roman Empire, which, of course, you know, the eastern half of the Roman Empire didn't fall when the West did. So it's quite different. It's all Hellenized to a certain extent. There are long traditions of empires there, and long traditions also of internal strife, civil wars, rebellions, etc. So I don't think that was considered particularly out of the ordinary.
Wars pull people together, whether they're popular or not. And if you're an expansionist empire, everyone's pulling together to fight certain things. Yet when Hadrian stabilizes the borders, you kind of lose that.
There's no external enemy to unite against.
Yeah.
As it were.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think there was always someone to fight against. Be that a big kind of an abstract enemy like the Jews, or be that the Germans, the Gauls, or on a local level. If you're a governor of a certain province, you're always going to have problems with your borders. I mean, banditry was always endemic wherever you went. There was always something to keep you occupied and to keep your local community kind of rallied around or rallying against, I think.
No, I think that's a good point also, that it's local problems mostly. It's not sure if the Roman Emperor would get reports from governors and from commanders at garrisons and forts and whatnot, but I don't think there was that the empire as such was as strong as its weakest link, basically. So you had all these different more or less autonomous provinces governing themselves, and I don't really think there was a sense of the empire versus the rest of the world as such, more like trouble spots here and there. And as time went on, the trouble spots became more pronounced and started to interfere with the daily running of the empire in the fringes, I guess.
Yeah, the fringes as well. As Joshua was saying, I don't think from the evidence, I don't think we can say that it was almost like a spider web where you have the emperor in the middle and all the strands stretching out to the different parts of the empire, and he sat and kind of in the middle feeling the pull of all different things going on and reacting to them. I think it's interesting, if you look at the letters of Pliny when he's governor of, I think it's Bithynia, he's the letters that have survived, and they're quite interesting reading, because Pliny seems to want to ask Trajan everything, and yet a lot of the letters from Pliny to Trajan are quite long. What do you think I should do? I've got this problem and that problem on my borders. I've got these bandits. Shall I move these troops from here to there? And oftentimes the reply will be from Trajan almost, all fine, yeah, do whatever. Bye, Trajan. So you get the impression that he just wants his governors to use their initiative and to just come to him with the problem. Come to him and tell him what your solution had been.
I think that's a bit of cronyism, really, on Pliny's part, really. I mean, it's him sucking up to the emperor, saying, "I'm your mate. I want to make sure I'm doing the right thing out here." And the emperor basically saying to him, "You know, do what you've been put there to do, and don't bother me about it."
Yeah, I think so too. Also, there is the very real problem, of course, that sending a letter to Rome from Bithynia that would take a while. And if there's some kind of problem, if there's like an army of bandits or something on your borders, you don't want to wait 8 days for Rome to get back to you on what you're supposed to do. So it was probably just Pliny being very polite or chummy, or sucking up to Trajan or whatever you want to call it, than a real... Yeah.
You'd think after the first few replies, when Trajan was quite curt in his reply, you'd think Pliny would have got the message that, oh, maybe I'm annoying him now, maybe I should stop this.
No, it does happen. I mean, you do see it in history elsewhere, where you see, for example, with the in the Bronze Age, with Canaanite vassals sending letters to the king in Egypt saying, I have this problem, one by one all these city-states are falling, what should I do, you should send me archers and that sort of stuff. But that's much shorter, of course, because, you know, the Levant isn't that far from Egypt, you know. So the you could imagine a dispatcher on a horse riding from one end to the other in a couple of days, but, you know, when you've got the Roman Empire at the scale that it operates, it's very unlikely that a governor somewhere on the fringe would constantly ask the emperor, hey, I'm thinking about doing this. Do you think that's a good idea, or should I do something else? Maybe for long-term things, like I'm thinking about increasing the taxes here. Is that a good idea? But
that's one of the things that's mentioned in the first Jewish revolt, that the commander, whoever's in charge of the cohort in Judea at the time, refers matter to his superiors and doesn't get much of a response to it initially, and then gradually, bit by bit, action is taken. But it is, if you like, passing the buck down the chain of command, saying deal with it yourself before we actually bring in the troops properly and actually respond to the whole thing.
There's an element of, as well, depending, I mean, even local issues, depending who your commander is, who your governor is, if they're of a personality where they're going to hold you personally responsible, if a decision you took at the spur of the moment didn't work out the way you thought it was going to, you know, you don't want to open yourself up to those kind of criticisms, do you?
No.
And so there could be an element of that as well.
Yeah, you see that in the army, at least, where you have officers asking their immediate superior for advice and that sort of stuff, probably, like you say, in order to make sure that they don't, you know, they suddenly they lose an entire cohort. Oops. to avoid those kinds of problems.
That's been a problem with armies throughout history, hasn't it? I mean, I think the Red Army in the Second World War, a lot of those, when Stalin had his purges, and a lot of those guys were political appointments. They didn't know a lot about military matters. They were forever kicking things upstairs, and just—I mean—it could paralyze an army if you get too much of that kind of thing.
Yeah, there were a lot of career officers basically also in the Roman army, because one of the ways in which you could improve your station, especially if you weren't of noble family, was of course to serve in the army and try to suck up to the people in a higher rank and to make sure that they could get you a better job. So you weren't really in the army for, you know, because you were through and through a military man, because you wanted to get higher up in the Roman echelon. So I could really imagine that if you were in such a situation and you had to make a military decision, you'd rather, you know, confer to the guy who actually knows something about military matters and take responsibility for it yourself.
And of course there's a lot of new men coming in at this time into the Roman army. That, I mean, after the time of Nero and getting rid of some of the main families in Rome, really them being decimated, you've got people really trying to make a name for themselves in whatever capacity.
Well, I think we should leave things there. That seems like a good place to end. I'd like to thank Lindsay, Joshua, Mark and Joseph. For more information on the magazine, go to ancient-warfare.com. I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.